Okay, we ready to start? I believe so. Ready to go. Okay, here we go. One from the middle. And the first lucky question is Christmas family time. I find it really difficult when I gather with my big family for Christmas for many days. Can you give some advice on how to handle the lack of silence, the negative discussions? They love to discuss all the problems of the world, the overload of things and food. Everybody has so much that they all want to buy more. Thank you. That's easy. You change your religion to being a Buddhist. And we celebrate letting go. Now, sometimes, that quite surprised me as well. One of the first times I went to visit my family in England after spending about 7 years in Thailand. I hadn't been back to London at all. When I went back there, they had a big meeting, you know, with the whole family at Christmas time. And they started off really friendly. Oh, it's nice to see you. How are you? Where have you been? About half an hour later, why haven't you written? Why didn't you do this? And it's really strange that we sometimes have so much negativity because that's what we see in the newspapers, that's what we see on the television. You know, the old two bad bricks and a wall story. You all know that one, I hope. Yeah. And so it becomes our custom always to find fault with everything, even the people we love and our relations. You know, the thing with relations is you're stuck with them for life. They share your genes. And so I was quite surprised how people speak to one another in a family. So I was fortunate because I was a monk, then I could leave. And when I came back next time, I made sure I don't spend too much time, you know, with the family, because after a while they start off speaking nice things, and then after a while it gets worse and worse and worse. It's really weird. So anyway, you have your family. Sometimes you have to go and see them unless you can invent a good excuse. One good excuse is you go and see them and start coughing. And I said, oh my goodness, this might be COVID, so I'm going to go back home just out of care for you and escape. I don't know, but it's true. People think we have to talk to show our love for one another and a care for one another. But sometimes on a retreat like this, even this is only a weekend retreat, so it's not that silent, be honest. But if you can be more silent, it'd be great. But on these long retreats, I say, it's wonderful you don't speak to one another, but that doesn't mean you don't smile at one another. And sometimes when you're sensitive, you've meditated for a few days, and a simple smile conveys so much more than words could ever convey. People actually are being kind to you. You don't have to prove that you like them and you care for them. You give them this beautiful gift of silence. Even over in Stroud, when I arrived there, one of our hosts gave me a little Christmas present. Raz, yeah. He gave a present. He said, this is a Christmas present for you, Ajahn Brahm. It's in a nice little box. I had to be careful it wasn't an eel. When I opened the box, he said, you've often told me this is what you always wanted, but find it very difficult to get. When I opened it, it was what I always wanted. Nothing. It was empty. And that's not a joke. Now, as a monk, as a nun, sometimes it's nice to get the place where you can stay. And it's nice to be able to get people who care for you and help you. But, you know, one of the greatest gifts you can give people is the gift of silence, of peace. Saying that, you know, we can look after you, carefully give you a nice lunch. But on Christmas in the afternoon, peace and goodwill to all beings. And peace means that silence. So you can just be. You don't have to prove anything to anybody. You don't have to tell them how much you love them. I remember this Englishman many years ago. He said, when he was interviewed on TV, that his mother-in-law comes to visit him at Christmas every year. She comes to the house every year. But last year, he made an exception. He let her in. That's a joke. Sorry. But even you always should be kind to all beings, but sometimes those jokes, I never saw that one coming, so that made me laugh. But it is true. All the problems of the world. There's something which I often say, that if you look at the world, if you look at the people around you, and if you look at Norway, you know, sometimes I come here and what a beautiful country it is. You know, you're very comfortable. And you've got a very good, what I think is a good social system. But anyway, if you actually live here, you can find all the faults with it. Ajahn Brahm, you're only here for a few days, you can't see it. Maybe I can, but I can also see the beautiful parts as well. So when you go into a garden, please make sure you look at the flowers and the bushes and the wonderful trees. Don't look at the faults. Don't look at the weeds. I always say plant flowers rather than weeds. And then the flowers, they will choke the weeds and the weeds will disappear. And anyway, what are weeds anyway? They're natural flowers. For some reason they've got a bad reputation, so people don't like them. I love weeds. You know, one of the reasons I love weeds is because they don't need any care. They just grow by themselves. I'm a lazy monk, so it's nice having weeds. And each one of you have your weeds. That makes you lovable. So anyway, that's the first question. And everybody has so much that they want to buy more. That's the thing which I can't understand. It's true. And also, I'm saying this, but be careful with giving things to monks and nuns. Can I say this? That sometimes, you know, what do monks eat? And nuns eat? Say chocolate. Sometimes you wouldn't believe how much chocolate we get. So much so we give it to you. And then you give it back to us. I suppose that's how the economy works. Oh, I should tell you how the economy works. You know that story? Don't mind me. I won't finish these anyway, even I've got an hour and a half. This was in a monastery, a Buddhist monastery, in the foothills of the Himalaya Mountains. And the old abbot, who was very wise, a very good meditator, he died, he passed away. So they elected a new abbot, and this other abbot, who was a very good monk, but he was, you know, not as deep meditator as the previous one. And so when it got to, you know, the autumn time, the monks would always ask the abbot whether it was going to be a cold winter or not. Because if it was really cold, they had to collect so much wood from the forest. So it was that time, so they asked the new abbot, how much wood should we collect from the forest? And so the new abbot said, well, leave it with me tonight. I will meditate and I will let you know in the morning. So the new abbot meditated, but he knew he wasn't as deep a meditator as the previous abbot. So when it got to maybe 11 p.m. or close to midnight, he got out his mobile phone and he rang the meteorological office. So what's the forecast for the winter? And they said, well, we don't really know yet, but we have this professor of meteorology here, and he's really smart, he'll let you know. So the abbot, he was anonymous, and he asked the meteorological professor, is it going to be a cold winter? And the professor said, well, it's maybe average winter. As far as we know so far, average. And so in the morning, the abbot sort of told the monks, I've seen last night that it's going to be an average winter. So we still need to collect lots of wood, but not too much. And they all said, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And they collected lots of wood the next week. And then they asked him again, is this enough? He said, leave it with me. I'll check tonight. And so when all the monks were asleep, he got out his mobile phone and called the professor again. The professor didn't know who was calling. He said, how's the signs? Is it going to be a really cold winter or just average? And that's when the professor said, actually, the signs have got worse. So I think it's going to be quite cold this winter. Thank you. And so the next morning, the abbot said, I've discovered last night that this year it's going to be quite cold. The signs have got worse. So I think we need to work really hard collecting more wood. And so the monks, they were just so busy working so hard collecting more wood. And they're storing it everywhere in the monastery. And after 1 week, they said, is this enough? And he said, leave it with me. I'll tell you tomorrow morning. So when all the monks were asleep again, he got out his mobile phone and he got the professor's number. How is it? You know, is it still a cold but not too cold winter? The professor said, interesting you ask that question. But the signs have got much worse. I really think it's going to be a very cold winter this year. Oh, thank you. But the monk sort of paused and said, how do you know it's going to be a very cold winter this year? And the professor of meteorology replied, because all the monks in that holy monastery have been collecting so much firewood, it must be a cold winter. And someone explained to me that's how the stock market works. Do you currently have ties with the Thai Sangha? Spelt differently, ties and Thai Sangha. Yes, I do have many ties there. Because even though so if it's the Wat Pa Pong Sangha, that's only a small part of the Thai Sangha. They kicked me out for ordaining bhikkhunis. I'm quite legitimate. It's an interesting story, interesting event, because these were the monks I grew up with, I cared for. We had wonderful stories together. And then it came to summoning me to a meeting in Wat Pa Pong. All these hundreds of monks were there, and I was just trying to defend myself, what I did and why I did it. But it went on for about 3 hours, and at the very end of that meeting, it all came down to, they said, well, Ajahn Brahm, if you tell us, all of us here, that those four women who I ordained as bhikkhunis legitimately, if you say they are not bhikkhunis, then all will be forgiven. And at that time, I was, you know, this was the last part of the ceremony, and I thought, if I say they're not bhikkhunis, I can have no more problems and troubles in my life, maybe. But then I would let down those four women and also all the other people, many, many people who supported them. And it was not possible to take an easy way out. It was one of those times in your life you do have a choice. You know, take the easy option, what other people would ask you to do, or just stand your ground. So I did stand my ground. And so I'm very happy I made that choice, because otherwise I wouldn't have been able to live with myself and be peaceful with myself or respect myself. There comes a time when you know what's right and you have to follow that course no matter what. So that's what I did. And afterwards, a lot of people said that, you know, you will be on the right side of history. Later on, when people see and appreciate what you've done, they realize it was the correct thing to do. Of course, it was the correct thing to do. I've got no regrets there at all. So we still have ties with the Thai Sangha, and one of the reasons was that I do have many friends in the Thai Sangha, senior friends, in the Council of Elders. These are the senior monks, and I was asking them, you know, have I done anything wrong? And they said, no. There's nothing wrong there. It's just political, that's all. And because I live in the West, I'm quite safe. But I still go visit Thailand. And even when they elected their new head monk, Sangharaja, I was actually called by another of the senior monks because he wanted to just see me so I could pay respects to him on camera, on TV. So what he was actually saying, that there's a lot of those monks, senior monks in Thailand, who want the Bhikkhuni Sangha resuscitated, coming back. They want that to happen. They just need royal support, and they need support of some of the senior monks, not the old monks. I always call the old monks in Thailand the movers and the shakers. You know why I say they're movers and shakers? Parkinson's. They're really old, and so they don't have like the courage or the energy actually to do things which other people would say was controversial. But anyhow, it will happen for sure. I say that knowing the Thai Sangha. Look, all the Thai people you know, if they, and I know many of them, they see bhikkhunis in Thailand and they offer them alms, they respect them, they can't see what the problem is. It's only sometimes we respect senior monks too much. The same in Sri Lanka too. There's lots of bhikkhunis over there. But the people who run the Sangha in Sri Lanka are the three they call Mahanayakas. These are leaders of the three main sects of Buddhism. They're old. And because of their age, again, they too, just are too, I would say, too scared of actually doing something which is new. It's not new, it's just been there for so many centuries. And I remember just, there's one of the big monasteries, royal monasteries, in Bangkok, Wat Pho. It's where they have the Emerald Buddha, if I'm not mistaken. And they have old paintings on the wall. And those old paintings are supposed to represent bhikkhunis in Thailand. You ask the senior monks, there had never been bhikkhunis in Thailand. So I conclude in those days, the monks had breasts. You can see them very clearly. So anyhow, that it's a matter of time. Look, how many of you here think there should not be bhikkhunis? Any of you? How many of you are happy to see a bhikkhuni here? There we go. So democracy wins. Before I did those ordinations, I asked our Thai community over in Perth. Perth is a big city. I don't know, about 2 million, I think, people now. And we have a large Thai population. And the Thai monastery in Perth is my monastery. Other people have tried to start up a Thai monastery, they don't get support. Or the Thai people come to my monastery. I was in Thai many years and became a Chalkun, which is like a very senior monk, given by the former king of Thailand. So because of that, you've got cred. And the Thai people love what we do. And because of that, they vote, you know, with their support, which is one of the reasons why that even when there's a katina ceremony, they go to Dhammasava, the Bhikkhuni monastery, to offer the katina. They treat us as evenly as possible. I must say that, but we do always get the most support. But anyway, there is enough support there for the bhikkhunis, and they're respected, which is wonderful. Are you supporting the Thai bhikkhunis in Thailand? If so, how? The head Thai bhikkhuni in Thailand, Venerable Dhammananda, yes. She was the one who put me into trouble. She came to Bodhinyana Monastery for a conference when she was still Dr. Kabbalah Singh, Chatsuman Kabbalah Singh. She was a doctor, had her own TV program supporting Buddhism there. And she said to me, as she said in public, she said, what we really need, you know, is a senior Western monk to do that ordination. And she said, Ajahn Brahm, you know, it'd be wonderful if you were a Chow Kun. If you were, it kind of makes you untouchable. So he said, as soon as you're a Chow Kun, Ajahn Brahm, we should do the Bhikkhuni ordination. And it was that weekend I got the email, you've been elected to be a Chow Kun, can you come? So he put me in not a difficult spot, a wonderful spot, and says, okay, yeah, let's do it. So we did it. Right according to the Vinaya. Nothing was wrong there at all done perfectly. And that really upset people. That there was no mistakes. It was all done perfectly. No one could question it. So because of that, it'd be wonderful if they could have found something wrong, then they could have something to argue about it. They didn't. Oh, you got it down here. You asked because I'm a disciple of, you got Luang. Luang Mer. I've never heard her called Luang Mer before. But anyway, Luang Mer Dhammananda. And at Nakhon Phanom, any thoughts? Yes, I've been there many times. And it's also, it's her, I think it's either a birthday or anniversary day coming up soon. And they've asked for quite a few of her friends to say something online on that birthday celebration without her knowing about it. So I was surprising her. So I'm supposed to be one of those for saying congratulations. She's gone through a lot of hard times. Her mother became a nun and was put in jail for being a nun. Something wrong there. But anyway, her full support. Any comments about that? Okay. And if I do go to Thailand and they put me in jail, thank you, thank you, thank you. I can now have a retreat. Ajahn Brahm, through deep hypnosis, broke through and came into a state of bliss. This was my first experience of nimitta. The following day, I wanted to get back to this and try to force myself back at the beach on a dark night, but I was terrified, as I'm sure I saw some demons. Is this real? Is this made by my mind? Because I tried to force it back to the blissful state. Luckily I've experienced nimittas on retreats after this, but then I don't let go and stay for hours. Can you go in and out at this stage? Is it like riding a bicycle when you get the experience? That's maybe a nice simile. When you get the experience, you ride a bicycle, you learn how to stay upright. But just because you know how to ride a bicycle, don't go too fast. There are things to be scared of, like big trucks when you're riding a bicycle, or the snow on the roads. So be careful. But anyway, it's strange that you got into a nimitta under hypnosis. But nevertheless, it gives you the taste of what we call the taste of freedom. Because you feel so much blissful and free from many of the experiences of the body. And you wanted to get back to this and try to force it back at the beach on a dark night. But of course, you can't force these things. If you actually try to make it happen, you always fail. Because to get the nimittas and the peaceful states of mind, it's important that your will, your doer, settles down. Remember how the glass of water becomes perfectly still? I can't make it be still. I stop making it, stop holding it, stop forcing it, leave it alone. It becomes still all by itself. This is one of those other similes. This is a simile of the donkey and the carrot. What is your favorite food in Norway, Atenito? Some sort of fish, pickled fish? Norwegian meatballs. Okay. So suppose Ajahn Nito was a donkey. Now donkeys are extremely stubborn. You can hit him with a stick, he won't move. But instead of hitting the donkey with the stick, if you tie the stick to the back of the donkey's neck, so the front of the stick is maybe 2 foot in front of the donkey's head, put a string on the end of the stick, and a fried meatball on the end of the string. And then Ajahn Nito in his donkey incarnation, he sees that meatball, that really delicious meatball, 2 foot in front of him. Oh, what would he do? He'd move towards it. And as he moves towards it, he'll pull whatever his owner has tied to his back. That's how they get donkeys to pull carts. But then Ajahn Nito has been much smarter than the ordinary donkey. He knows how to catch that meatball. Usually the faster you run, the faster the meatball travels in front of you. You never catch up to it. It's always about 2 foot in front of you. But Ajahn Nito knows what to do. He runs as fast as he possibly can after that meatball. But then, because he knows Buddhism, he knows how to stop. He stops. What happens to the meatball? It swings further away from him. And it's about 4 foot in front of his mouth. But then he's patient. He stops and stays still. And then the meatball starts swinging towards the donkey. It swings to its usual place, 2 foot in front of his mouth, and swings even further, goes right close to his mouth. But because he was a disciple of Ajahn Brahm, he knows one of the most important phrases was when the meatball gets very close, he has to remember kindness. He says to that meatball, "Meatball, the door of my mouth is open to you." Otherwise it bounces off his teeth. That's how you catch meatballs if you're a donkey. And it's the same with how do you get back to these states? Forcing yourself doesn't work. Stopping, relaxing, more and more and more. And those states come back to you. And my terrified you saw demons. Those demons, okay, they are made by your mind. They cannot scare you. They cannot harm you. If a demon came in to you, when it comes this close, say, "Ah!" to the demon gets scared and runs away. Have a look at Buddhist cosmology. All these different realms you can get reborn into. Demons and ghosts are a lower realm. I don't know why, like, say, Thai people are afraid of ghosts, afraid of pee. Because you are much higher than the ghosts. And if you have some deep meditation, you will know, like I know, the ghosts are afraid of you. Especially monks and nuns. So look, if you have any hauntings, any sort of ghosts give you a hard time, say to them, "If you carry on misbehaving like this ghost, I will send Ajahn Nito to you." And they go, oh, no, 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 please, not Adjanito. The ghosts, this is, I'm not making this up, this is truth. The ghosts are afraid of monks. And nuns as well. Oh, nuns can be very scary. It's true. And what is the difference? What they are scared of, what empowers you and protects you, is your virtue. If you've got precepts and you keep those precepts, you're a good person. Ghosts can't harm you. And a story about that, we do have all these stories. When I was in Thailand, there was the story of this, a young lady. Now, she hadn't got married, but she was very interested in Buddhism, went to the temple, you know, often would keep 5 precepts all the time, 8 precepts on the moon days. And when she was keeping those precepts, one day she was just brushing her teeth in the mirror in the house in the village. And instead of seeing her face in the mirror, she saw a monster's face in the mirror. And she wasn't imagining, she actually saw it and she screamed. And her mother took her to the temple. They asked, what on earth is going on? We didn't know yet. But they invited the monks to do a little ceremony in the house. When they were doing this little ceremony in the house, I'm not quite sure which one it was. I think it was her, maybe her sister, fainted. And after they fainted, they were speaking in a really weird voice. They had become possessed, temporarily, by this monster who was trying to kill this girl. And so they had a very senior monk there at the time from Ajahn Chah's tradition. And the senior monk, you know, he'd seen this many times, he wasn't afraid. He said, who are you? And the monster, he said, I am that monster she saw in the mirror. And I've been contracted to kill her. I've been trying for the last couple of years. The reason was there was another young man who fell in love with her. She refused him. And so he thought, well, I'm rich enough, I can actually get this monster to kill her. And then, this is a true story, I'm not making this up. And then this monk said, look, you will not be able to kill her. She's actually protected by her precepts. She's too good a person. There's no faults in her at all. You can't get close to her. And the ghost admitted that, or the spirit admitted that. But then he also said, well, if I can't kill her, I have to die. And then the monk said, look, it is actually better that you die than you kill anybody. So the monk gave this demon the Buddha's 5 precepts. So she possessed another woman, apparently, when this was happening. And he gave this woman, who's speaking in a really weird voice, the 5 precepts, the Buddha's precepts. And after that, the woman came out of that possession and the demon was never seen again. I'm saying that as accurately as I possibly can, from the point of view of a theoretical physicist. Not as a silly monk, but as a science. This is what happens. You are protected. Dear Ajahn Brahm, thank you for being here. Well, I've got to be somewhere. Ever so often, I experience the biggest effect of meditation. After the meditation, when I don't try to meditate, I fall into very deep states. Exactly. When you're trying, you're blocking it. But so often, it's like when you're running after the meatball, it's always 2 foot in front of you. When you stop running, the meatball comes towards you. That is so incredibly common. There's one of these nuns, she's at Dharmasara now, Bhikkhuni Monastery. She was on one of my retreats many years ago in Phuket. And she was trying very hard to meditate. She wasn't getting anywhere, basically. But then, when the retreat was over, we did all the final ceremonies and thank everybody, loving kindness, all of that. When the retreat was over, her taxi taking her to the airport to get a flight to where she lived was not going to leave for a couple of hours. She had an hour free at the end of the retreat. So she told me she decided, what she said, the English phrase, to kill time. She had an hour to kill. So she went into the meditation room and sat down. The first time in 9 days she wasn't trying. Just killing time, that's all. And then afterwards, I was sitting down having a cup of tea or orange juice or something. She came down to me and kneeled on the floor, put her hands up. And this I'm imitating as best I possibly can as a man. Ajahn Brahm, oh, wonderful. Oh, Ajahn Brahm, it was such a wonderful experience. Oh. The first time in her life she got into a deep meditation. And it was like, you know, a young teenager, you know, falling in love. Oh, mummy, daddy, I've met this wonderful person. We're totally in love. That was the emotional afterglow of getting into a really deep meditation for the first time. She was blissed out. She's a nun now. I often tell people that story because when you try to get somewhere, you never do. So, I will tell you, all those of you who come in tomorrow, you've got no chance of getting deep meditation tomorrow. So just come and relax and enjoy yourself. And if you believe me, there's a very good chance you might get something. Anyway, I've only done 2 questions so far, goodness. No self, how to explain to my husband that his wife does not exist? Easy. I think he'd be very happy with you. He'd probably go and get another girlfriend. A few years ago, I decided to get what's called an Australian government, like elderly people's healthcare card. And because I was qualified, I think I was 70 at this time, and 60 or 65 is enough to get this Australian government healthcare card. I don't need it because I don't get sick. But anyway, that I went online, did all the form, and then I got the response back that because of the possibility of identity fraud, that I had to come in personally. So I went in, I made an appointment at the social services department. It's called Centrelink. What's the equivalent of that in Norway? Oh, police, okay. But anyway, I had to go and see somebody. And when I went there, that they made an appointment for me, and somebody sat in front of me, this lady, and she said, Ajahn Brahm, you need to prove who you are. And I responded to her with full honesty. I said, for the last 45 years, I've been trying to answer that question. I thought it was a funny answer, but she didn't. She said, this is serious. Can you prove who you are? So anyway, then she said, I need some ID. Have you got your driver's license? As a monk, I don't have a driver's license. So I said, okay, let's see your credit card. I don't have a credit card. Your bank account details. I don't have a bank account. Or your home loan. I don't have a home. Your ownership of your place where you stay. I don't own anything. Have you got your rental agreement? I don't have a rental agreement. I live in a cave. You know what she asked me next? My marriage license. I'm a monk, I don't get married. And then she looked at me and she said, well, according to the government, you don't exist. And I said, I couldn't resist it. I said, sadhu, 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 the Buddha was right. I proved it. And that, I don't make that up. That actually happened. And then what she did, I was obviously causing her a lot of trouble. So I said, well, have you got a passport? Yeah, I've got two passports, Australian passport and British passport. She said, I'm only supposed to accept one, but I'll accept two to get rid of you. And so, no, she had fun. I wasn't being too aggressive, just making life difficult. So eventually she got rid of me and just gave me this healthcare card. And also I understood now from the Australian government that I do not exist. So that's your no-self. How to explain that his wife does not exist. Again, don't do any explanations to people who will not understand them. Instead, just say about, you know, we practice a lot of non-hatred and kindness and sensitivity and awareness. So say those parts of, you know, the Dhamma which will make your husband appreciate you coming to the temple and deepening your practice. What happens next, if you become more peaceful and more kind, then your husband starts to get very interested. Why? He said, well, come to the temple and find out. And he comes, and after a while, it's really weird, he starts coming more than you do. He said, I've fallen in love with this wonderful person at the temple. Who? Well, come and find out. And he comes along and said, with the Lord Buddha. I've fallen in love with the Buddha. Ajahn, how do you find the right balance between doubt and faith, trust in Buddhism? I feel like too much doubt becomes a hindrance and faith without some doubt becomes blind faith. Any input or thoughts on this would be very appreciative. Indeed, it's a simile which I've used to explain doubt and how to actually go forward with it. Was an experience which I had as a young student. I couldn't afford, you know, to go on fancy holidays, and also I didn't want to. So most of my vacations, actually I did one vacation over here to Norway, went up to the North Cape, but other times I would just go up to Scotland, it's a bit closer. And when I went up to Scotland, I would just go walking in the mountains. Had a tent, I knew how to look after myself. And one day, up in the far north of Scotland, I was staying in a youth hostel, and in that youth hostel, so there was only myself and the hostel, I think warden they called it. And so one day we decided, it was a beautiful day, sunny, reasonably warm, we decided to go walking up to one of the mountains. We got to the top of the mountain. I said, I had lots of energy. There was another mountain close by. I said, let's go to the second mountain. He said, no, one is enough for me. So I made a big mistake, and that was going up these mountains alone. You should never do that. So I went up the second mountain alone, and I couldn't believe how a beautiful blue sky with not a cloud in the sky, that's so quickly a bank of clouds came from the west, and it came right over the mountains. I was almost at the top of the second mountain, and then came down and enveloped me in mist, which was so thick I couldn't see my hand in front of me. What really shocked me was how fast that all happened, within 10 minutes. And I thought, well, I can't go to the top of the mountain now. I'll just retrace my steps so I can get back to where I came from. And that was the first time I realized how disorientated you can become when you're in the mist. You think you know your way, but you don't. Because what happened, I was walking, and then the ground in front of me was not there. There was a big cliff in front of me, literally one step, and I would not be here today. I'm not exaggerating that. later on I traced the only place there was such a cliff was in the totally opposite direction which I thought I was going in. But that, you know, close experience of death made me scared. And I thought, this is not a joke, this is a very serious situation, being lost in the mist up in the mountains. I couldn't see where I was going. But I remembered my science, remembered the law of gravity, that water always flows downhill. So I found a little stream. There's lots of little creeks up in those mountains. Found one and I followed it. Whichever way that stream went, I was going to follow it. I wasn't going to take any shortcuts, just keep following it. When I did that, the stream met another little stream and then a bigger stream and a bigger stream, and all the time it was going downhill. And then just one more step and you were suddenly underneath the mist. It was actually quite sudden, a couple of steps up and you were deep in the mist, a couple of steps down and you were under the mist and you could see where you were going. And that's how I escaped. It was a long way around, but I got back to the youth hostel afterwards. And I've used that for the simile of doubt. Sometimes when you first start a spiritual path, you don't know which way to go. All of your teachers, different types of teaching, different types of Buddhism, different types of spirituality, they all say kind of similar things, but there are some differences to it. Which one should you follow? It's very confusing in today's world. Now, even in Norway, finding a teacher who's authentic. So what should you do? You find a stream, and you follow that stream as long as it goes downhill. Do these teachings, do they lead to peace? Do they lead to joy? I mention that because that's an important part of the spiritual path. It should make you happier, more joyful, more peaceful. And if you can't notice that, your friends and family should be able to notice that. And when you go back home in the evenings, you're much more peaceful, kind, loving human being than when you started coming here. You're following a stream and you're going in the right direction. And the Buddha actually said that to many people. When people asked him, what is the Dhamma? What are the teachings of the Buddha? Whatever lead to that giving up of things, to peace, tranquility, to things ending, ceasing, you can know that as the teachings of the Buddha. That was giving to the first bhikkhuni, Mahapajapati. And it's also given to his Baba as well, Upali. And they used that and became totally enlightened. When you meditate, does that make you feel better or feel worse? If it makes you feel worse, you're going in the wrong direction. No matter who says that. If I say that, don't do that. But if you make it more peaceful, more kind, you feel it's getting more profound and more wise, then carry on. That's how we overcome doubt. Faith in things. Please never have blind faith. There's a story of some nuns. There were nuns. Actually, they weren't fully ordained nuns. I think that was a problem. And they were going in England to, I think it was going to Heathrow Airport. And the driver, who was an eight preceptor, was told by the senior nun, said, go straight ahead at the roundabout. And so the driver thought, well, these are nuns, they're holy, they must have psychic powers. So when she got to the roundabout, she did actually go right over it. Not a joke, it actually happened. That's what we call blind faith. Don't do that. But she, you know, the senior nun there said, I didn't mean go straight ahead, I meant go round and then exit at, you know, what they call that, 12 o'clock. But anyway, she went straight over the roundabout. So, but be careful of having blind faith. Because number one, you don't know the person who told you to do that Do they really know what they're doing? Number two is what they said. Do you understand what they said and understand it well enough? Faith is very dangerous. So I would say do not have blind faith. You can trust a little bit, but always have a, what do I do if it doesn't work? And you can always come back in. That's what I said, that even some of these deep meditations, they feel dangerous. Just go a little bit further. And make sure you can always come out again. And then you'll find that actually they're not dangerous at all. Does that make sense? I can only focus on three consecutive breaths before my mind wanders off. What am I doing wrong in the previous state? What you're doing is you're assuming you have to be watching your breath. That's your goal. I'm going to watch the breath. And see if you can beat your personal best and do four breaths. That's not what meditation is. Meditation is being aware and being kind. So your mind wanders off. If the mind wanders off, you wander off with it. You let it go. Be kind to it. And then it never wants to wander away from you. After, I don't know, maybe 13 or 14 years, I met one of my old friends from Cambridge times. And he was the head, not auditor, was it? Not accountant. No, he was a actuary, yes. It was the highest paid job. And he was the head actuary for the whole of Europe. Sorry? Yeah, but anyway, he was a very sort of senior figure in the actuary world. But because I went to college with him, we always remember the story when one night at a party he got drunk and he went into the toilets, you know, to just to do some business. When he came out, he forgot to put his trousers on. So all the people, we were about 19 at the time, all the people around at that party, we saw him. And so his name was Harry. So he always got this nickname, Flash. Flash Harry, that was his nickname. All the students remembered him as Flash. And so when I when I met him, I said, "Hi, Flash, how are you?" That's all he knew him by that name. And he said, "Ajahn Brahm, don't say that name. I'm the senior head actuary of the whole of Europe." It embarrassed me. I said, "Okay, I won't mention that name." But we were the best of friends. I was a monk, he was Flash. And so we started talking. And it was a fascinating experience because we started talking and we just couldn't stop talking together. And I said, "Look, there are some Sri Lankan people going to feed me my lunch today." So I went into the restaurant. I said, "It's okay if he comes too and sits next to me because we've got unfinished business. You know, all this talking we had to do." I said, "Yeah, please." We were talking right through the meal. And then after the meal was finished, I never paid any attention to these wonderful Sri Lankan people who were feeding us. And afterwards, we still hadn't finished. I was going to the Thai temple next to give a talk. And so he came on the underground with me to the Thai temple. We were talking all the way. And when we got to the Wimbledon underground station, then we walked to the Thai temple all the way. It was only when there was a big crowd there, I said, "Look, I have to stop talking now, I don't want to," but it was somebody you cared for and you felt so safe with and so friendly to. You didn't want to stop talking. And that was over about 2 or 3 hours. And you know I very, very rarely do that to anyone. And I remember that's like watching your breath for 3 hours. Sometimes you and your breath are such good friends. You can't not stay with your breath. It's like being with a best friend you haven't seen for a while. "Hi, how are you, breath? What have you been up to?" "Oh, yeah, I've been really difficult. I've been going to Norway, doing a lot of talks." "What have you been doing, breath?" "Oh, I've still been coming in and out of your body." You know, we're best of friends, and I really mean that. And when you see an old friend you haven't seen for years, of course, you know, you just can't avoid hanging out with them. And that is actually how you watch your breath or anything in your meditation. Make friends with it first. And if you can only watch 3 or 4 breaths, that is, your breath is scared of you. You've been controlling it too much. So if your breath wants to run away, fine, breath, off you go. Have a nice time. There was this, if you haven't heard this story, this woman over in Australia, she had a 5 or 6 year old kid, and one day the kid said to Mummy, "Mummy, I don't love you anymore, I'm leaving home." And this was an incredible mother, I really respect her. She said, "Oh, you want to leave home? Fine, I will let you pack. I will help you pack." So the mother went into her kid's bedroom, in a small little suitcase, and put all the important things in life, like the Spider-Man costume and the lucky pants and totally useless stuff. And having packed a suitcase for her kid, they said, "Oh, before you go, you know, you have to have something to eat in your life." So they made the kid the favorite sandwich, you know, put it in a nice brown paper bag and kissed the kid off at the door. "Have a nice life, son. Don't forget to keep in touch." And then a little kid walked down the little garden path to the gate, carrying a suitcase and a paper bag with his favorite lunch in it, turned the corner and went off into his life for the first time. He got about 20 meters down the road and then felt terribly, terribly homesick, as a 6-year-old kid would when your mother really loves you and shows how she loves you. And then he turned around, went through the garden gate, and the mother hadn't left from the front door of the house. "Welcome home, darling." That's what I call emotional intelligence. She let the kid go with my favorite food and also just with a big kiss. "Have a nice life." No one would want to leave a mother like that. In fact, if that was me, I would leave every afternoon to get my favorite food in a brown paper bag. Anyway, my parents are kind people, but I never feel close or good connection with them in my head. Spending half a day with my mum is enough for me each time I visit them. How can I let go of the guilty feelings I have to be there for my parents, 78, 81, when they seem they don't need me? A lot of times your parents probably feel they don't want to burden you, that you have your own life, and they just want you to be free. But sometimes when your parents do get quite elderly and you need to look after them, basically, why not? A similar story was of this Vietnamese girl over in Perth. All these experiences of Perth, because that's where I live, and I accumulate all these stories for many years. This Vietnamese girl, she married this Australian man. They really looked after each other. And they loved each other. They were great together. But she had a mother-in-law, this Australian woman. And the Australian woman said, to her son, why did you marry a Vietnamese? Aren't there enough beautiful girls who are Australian? You know, she's a bit of a racist. Actually, not a bit, but quite a lot. But anyway, the girl was a really good girl, a good Buddhist, and she really tried her hardest to be kind to her mother-in-law, but nothing seemed to work. So she went to the temple. She meditated, she chanted, she tried her very best to do something to get her mother to respect her. Nothing worked. So one day she was at the temple apparently meditating and she actually fell asleep. And in her sleep, she dreamed of a statue of the Mahayana goddess of mercy, Kuan Yin. You know what I'm talking about? You've got a Kuan Yin statue here? Oh yeah, okay, that's the Tibetan Kuan Yin. This was like the Vietnamese Kuan Yin. And it looked just like the normal statue of Kuan Yin. But there was something different about this statue of Kuan Yin which she saw in her dream. It had the face of her mother-in-law. And she said when she saw her mother-in-law with the face of Kuan Yin with the face of her mother-in-law, that totally changed her relationship to her mother-in-law. She thought she was trying her best, but now she saw her mother-in-law as a goddess of mercy. And from that day on, her relationship totally changed with her mother-in-law. And now they're the very, very, very best of friends. Not just mother-in-law and daughter-in-law, but really close together. What's the Buddha way of seeing the war in Ukraine and other wars? What to do with Putin? So I'll leave that question to the very wise Ajahnita. Passing the buck. Now what happens there is that maybe Mr. Putin was a very strong leader and maybe a good leader at the beginning, but sometimes when leaders stay in power for too long, it always happens. They get corrupted by the power. Even one of the other most powerful beings in the universe is this person called Mara, M-A-R-A. And he's in a very high heavenly realm. Why is he messing around so much? Because power does corrupt. That's one of the reasons why in a Buddhist temples we do have democracy. Even when we did the ordination, the first ordination for bhikkhunis, we had to all meet together and should we do this or should we not do this? They all knew I wanted to do it, but I had to listen to all the other monks. And the lay community, we didn't have any nuns in. But then we had to make sure that the democratic system was what worked. There was no leader. You may think I'm the titular leader, but then I get outvoted many times. And I'm kind of happy about that. And if you have power and nothing to check you, then it's very, very dangerous. So, even with someone like Putin, there should always be a limit on the number of years, or for some politicians, the number of days. You can be a leader. A number of hours would be better. So, and this is what happens afterwards. People think that Ukraine is ours, that it's Russian, that we have to take it back. No one owns a country. People do. You know, Sweden. I think Sweden used to own Norway, didn't they? So who's the president of Sweden now? Be careful. Of course, countries change, people change. The democracy may not be the most efficient way to lead a country. You don't get things done quickly. And you have lots of arguments. But in the end, sort of it's a much safer way of running countries, safer way of running monasteries. Could you please tell us more about breathing during the meditation? Yes, please carry on breathing during the meditation. But sometimes the breath does stop. And you bliss out. You're so quiet you don't need to breathe again. At least for a while until you come out of the meditation. Have we got time to do a scary story? It's not really scary. Because the person involved says one of the most wonderful experiences of his life. A lay person. His name was Greg in Australia. He's meditating with me, maybe do 30 minutes or 40 minutes max of meditation. But a Sunday afternoon, nothing on the TV, so he decided to go in his bedroom and meditate for a little while. He does that often. But then after an hour, he hadn't come out of the bedroom. So his wife went to check on him. He was still meditating there, perfectly still. Too still. She couldn't see him breathing at all. So she called over in Australia, it's 000. What's the emergency number here in Norway?
113.
113. Thank you for that. So anyway, rang the emergency number 000, because it was a Sunday afternoon. An ambulance came, you know, within 5 minutes, and the medics ran into the bedroom. They checked his pulse, checked his breathing, whatever it was. Nothing. No breath, no pulse apparent. So they put him in the back of the stretcher, and they rushed him to the hospital. Do-do-do-do-do-do. With all the sirens going really fast. Do-do-do-do-do-do. I don't know if that's good good sound effects, but anyway, that's all you're getting. And when he got to the hospital, straight into the emergency room, triaged, they put an ECG on him, an EEG as well. Both flatlined. Usually, that means dead. But the nice bit of this story was that the doctor on duty that afternoon was of Indian descent. And this Indian doctor had heard from his parents that sometimes these yogis in India, this guy was Australian, in India can suspend all their life activities through meditation. And also there was something odd about this man. He had no pulse, no heartbeat, no brain activity according to the instruments, but his body was still warm. And that's fascinating, because in one of the suttas in the middle-length sayings, the Majjhima Nikaya, it's a Chula-Vedana, or the Mahavedana, but in one of those suttas they say the difference between a person in a deep meditation and one who's dead. In deep meditation, your body is warm, maintains a warmth. In death, you go cold. He was still warm. So in those days, apparently, they put on defibrillators, these electric shocks, to try and get the heart going again. I think these days they give it injections of adrenaline or something. I'm not sure. But anyway, in those old days, electric shocks. And I've seen demonstrations of those electric shocks. It's really powerful. You come up from the gurney or the stretcher you're on. Many times they gave electric shocks. None of them worked. He's still flatlined. Until, this is what he told me, he decided to come out from his meditation. And as soon as he made that decision, he opened his eyes. Beep, beep, beep. The heartbeat was normal on the ECG, and even the EEG was working. The doctor could not believe this, but it happened. And all that time, the doctor gave him a quick check over his body. His body was perfect, nothing wrong with it at all. And so he allowed him to walk home with his wife. And when I asked him, I said, was anything unpleasant about that experience? He said, yes, there was. During that experience, it was very blissful, deep inside. That was blissful. The unpleasant part of that experience was the scolding he got from his wife on the way home. His wife really let him have it. Don't you ever do that again. I'm not going to let you do that again. You scared me. I thought you died. So anyway, that's when the breath can stop, naturally, because you don't need a breath at that time. These are the deep meditations. But you're perfectly safe. Even in the time of the Buddha, they tell the story of the monk who went into a deep meditation. This is in the time of the Buddha, in the forest. And two villagers, they were doing something in the forest, collecting mushrooms or something. They saw this monk, and they thought, it's not right to let this monk, who's obviously dead, be eaten up by the jungle animals. They're in the forest anyway. It didn't take them much time to collect enough wood to make a funeral pyre. And when they put this monk on top of the funeral pyre, they did whatever chanting they could remember, which wasn't much. And then they lit the fire. And once the fire was lit, they thought, the fire would do the rest. We've done our service. It will burn up. And so they went off to collect their mushrooms. And the following morning, that monk walked for arms round in the village. Not even any part of his robe was burnt. So be careful. If Ajahn Nito is very, very still in meditation, don't cremate him. Because when he comes out of the ovens, he say, "Hi, I'm still here." You'll be unburnable. And there's other stories about that. This is true, believe it or not. So during the breathing meditation, I have a feeling a breath is not right. I am losing my breath when meditating. Great, let it go. If it needs to go, let it go. Your job is just to be an observer and trust your body. Sometimes the breath disappears, maybe for a minute or two. It's natural. Just because you have enough energy in your body, because you're not expending very much in deep meditation, you don't need breath. When you do need it, the lungs will do the breathing for you. Trust your lungs. My lungs have been looking after me over 71 years. They never failed me yet. They know me. I know my lungs. We have a wonderful time together. I trust them. Don't need to force anything or be scared about anything. We're almost finished. Oops. Can you please tell us a bit more about full bhikkhuni ordination for women? Why is it important that women can receive full ordination compared to other arrangements such as mechi and others? And what are the arguments of those monks who disagree with you? It's not a theory, it's not a philosophy. If a woman wants to become a bhikkhuni, it's their choice. And it's up to them to decide if they want to. My job is to make it possible for them if they want to. So you can ask a bhikkhuni why they want to be a bhikkhuni. And why it is because this is what the Buddha wanted. That's one reason. Why does a person want to become a monk? A full monk? Why? It is because the Buddha was saying that gives a much more authentic and accurate description of the Sangha in the time of the Buddha. It was there before. Why can't it be there after? Why can't it be there now? It's allowable. And it gives the bhikkhunis more authority. It's what the Buddha wanted. You can maybe say something about that later on, if you wish. How to deal with facial muscle tension? What I do to deal with facial muscle tension is every morning do 10 push-ups. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, in front of the mirror. Some of you are laughing. Where's that facial tension gone now? A lot of time, change the emotion and the tensions vanish. How to deal with chronic pain during meditation? If you do have chronic pain, try and find the most comfortable posture, but there'll still be chronic pain. And then understand that the pain has two parts to it. The mental reaction and the physical feeling. The physical feeling of the chronic pain, that is going to be there. But your mental reaction can change. You can let it be. Allow it to be. One of Greg's best friends This was a guy who got into the jhanas and went to hospital and confounded the doctor. One of Greg's best friends, he came up to me one time and he said, "I've finally done it." And I knew he was a deep meditator. "What have you done?" You know, and I kind of knew what he was talking about. I said to him, "Have you made the ECG flat?" He said, "No, that was easy." He's got the EEG flat now as well. Now that's quite an interesting thing to do. And he said, "Look at all the people in the back. Those are my doctors and therapists at this pain clinic which I go to. And they just want to find out what the heck is going on. Because that's not possible according to whatever they know." But he did it. And he had such really bad chronic pain. I think he said one of the 7 or 8 people in the whole state who were allowed legally to take whatever drug was available. You know, even sort of drugs which were illegal, you had a legal exemption to take those drugs because of the amount of pain you felt all the time. If you want to be inspired, then look at that book outside, Opening the Door of Your Heart. There's a poem in there by, I think it's called "It's Too Much to Hope For." And it goes something like, "It's too much to hope for a life without pain. It's too much to expect a life without pain, because pain teaches us to keep our foot from the fire, our finger from the thorn." But he said there are some types of pain which have no reason at all, such as chronic pain. They are just destroyer of your happiness, destroyer of your life, a great danger to your peace. But he said, "But there is a point to the pain." And he said, "The point of the pain is learning how to live life, to be at peace and joy in spite of that pain." He said, "That's a very special personal achievement, a very difficult achievement, one you have to experience to really know." And then I'm summarizing that poem as best I can. But it was written by someone called Jonathan Wilson Fuller. I got permission to pin that in Opening the Door of Your Heart, age 7 years of age. What I read, he was someone who was allergic to modern life, this was some years ago, to the 20th century, only 7 years of age. Could have been 9, I forget the numbers, but a really young kid. And that really just blew me away. He was so wise. He got to be at peace with the pain. So if you have chronic pain, please read that poem. It's beautiful. The Buddha developed the teaching of anatman, contra the Hindu atman. If there are no self, what is it that goes on to be reincarnated or reborn? A mango. You eat a mango, and after the mango is eaten, you take the seed, you plant it in the ground, and that mango splits, and a little plant comes up from that mango. And as that mango, just that little plant, reaches to the soil, it breaks through the soil. It looks like a piece of grass at first. But then, if it is protected and got enough water and good soil, it will grow to a little shoot, like a little flower plant or something. But then it gets bigger and bigger, taller and taller, and it gets thicker and thicker. It gets a wooden stem. It becomes what we call a sapling. And it gets bigger and bigger and then starts to form little branches. And you can see it's a little tree growing. And that tree grows bigger and bigger and it sprouts leaves from the end of its twigs. And then after a while it gets so big, at the end of those twigs you see little flowers growing. And some of those flowers get pollinated and you can see them swell at the base of the flower. And a little fruit starts to grow. And you wait. And then sooner or later, that little bud gets so big, it becomes a mango. And then later at the right time, when it's big enough and mature enough, you can take it from the tree and eat the new mango. The new mango didn't reincarnate from the old mango. What went across from the first mango to the second mango? It's a cause and effect process from beginning to end. The seed created the genetic material, the cause or whatever, which led to the next part of the process, splitting up, germinating, and growing, and growing, and growing. It was a process from beginning to end, but nothing which went from the first part of it to the last part of it. It's connected, but not the same. Not a self which goes from life to life, but a process. What has gone from your early life to this part of your life? If Ajahn Brahm, as a young kid who gave a eel to his mother, in that story, if I could suddenly materialize him now, no one would ever expect that that little kid became Ajahn Brahm. What went across? Actually nothing, just a process. From day to day to day to day, hour to hour, you grow and you change. But what was there in that early kid is not there in this old man, old monk. You've changed. Even, especially for a mango, even the DNA changes, mutates. There's nothing there in the beginning which was there in the end. It all keeps changing. So that's why we say that what went across, just a process goes across. That's all. What is the difference between reincarnation and rebirth? Not much. It's just a reincarnation. It's a technical term, means something here gets incarnated and put into a new body. It's like a transfer of some essence inside of you. Rebirth is just more accurate to the process of one thing leading to another, which leads to another, which leads to another. If there is no God that listens to prayer and answer, then why do Buddhists pray? Good Buddhists don't pray. They do something about the problem instead. But then again, there was this, I'll give credit to where it came from, this Hindu story. Somewhere in India, a very rich man went into the temple to do some praying to, the God he worshipped. And as he came out, there was a beggar outside the temple and was asking for money. And the rich man said, "Look, I work for my money and you're just begging for it." And the poor man said, "What do you mean? You don't work for your money. You go inside the temple and beg your God for good luck. I'm doing the same. I'm begging you for some money. What's the difference?" And this rich man said, "I never thought about it like that before. That's true. We're all beggars. Some people beg from God. You beg from me." So he gave him a few hundred rupees. Well, that's an interesting argument. Do you beg for something from a God? All you can ever get is some inspiration. Actually, I've got to be honest, haven't I? There was one time I asked for something from devas, from heavenly beings. The main reason I did this, because I wanted to find out if there really were these heavenly beings. Remember, I was a scientist, a theoretical physicist. I didn't really believe in all this rigmarole stuff. But then I always remember the story of this Thai monk who went to stay in Burma during the Second World War. And when the Japanese took over Thailand, then the British over in Burma thought that all Thais were partisans of the Japanese. And especially monks, they thought were spies. So in Burma in the Second World War, anyone who wore a brown robe was really suspected by the British military and interrogated. And so they all knew this, and so they told this Thai monk, you better leave the country as soon as possible, because we can't guarantee your safety. And you better not leave by the ordinary roads, because the British military were in charge of those. They'll arrest you and interrogate you. So the only way to get out of Thailand to be safe is to go through the jungles. So that's what this monk had to do. And I have spent a range retreat in those areas very close to the border between north of Thailand and Burma. And those mountains are incredibly steep. And they're very hot. And for him to actually to walk in that area, it's not just a danger of like tigers and snakes. It's the dangers of just not finding anything to eat or anything to drink. And that's what happened to this monk. After a few days or maybe a week or two in the jungle without any food, because it was remote, he started thinking that he would not be able to make the journey. He would die on the road. That was a very good possibility. And then he thought to himself that he was a good monk. He kept his precepts. He was a meditator. And he thought, I know there are heavenly beings. If there really are heavenly beings, can one of them help me survive this journey? And he said this in his biography, that he turned a corner in this jungle path and there was a man waiting for him in the middle of the path with what they call the tiffin can. Tiffin cans are these like bowls, they put one on top of the other to carry food when they go on some sort of journey. The bottom of the tiffin can is usually the rice, then maybe some sort of curry or something to eat with the rice, and some fruit on the top. And this man, you know, had one of these tiffin cans, and as he walked past this man, and a forest monk of my tradition, we're not supposed to ask for anything or even stop. We have to wait to be invited. And so this being in the middle of the jungle, so if he was well dressed, the monk could see that, which was weird. There's no villages around, no towns, and he was very well dressed. Usually people in the jungle, they literally do wear rags. And so he walked past this monk, this gentleman standing there, and this man said to him, Nimon Krap. Those are the words for invitation of a monk, Nimon Krap. So the monk stopped, opened his bowl, and this man in the middle of nowhere put hot rice. It was really warm, like it just come out of the kitchen, and these beautiful curries and fruit. He said, this is not jungle food. Jungle food is like animals, that's all they can get to eat, and potatoes. They don't have rice up there. And so he put this beautiful food in his bowl, and that was like unbelievable. And so this monk did something you're not usually supposed to do. He asked the man, where are you from? He hadn't seen a village for days. And what this man said? He didn't say anything, he just pointed upwards. Which the monk interpreted, like you may interpret, some sort of heaven realm. And he claims to this day that that was true. Without knowing this monk was coming, had food ready for him. And saved his life. Now, many years later, there was this young, he was thin at that time, monk from England who was walking in the jungles and mountains of northeast Thailand. Who do you think that monk was? I had enough to eat, but I hadn't seen a well or a river or anything to fill up my little, flask for a long time. It was a really hot day, it was very sunny. I was getting dehydrated. I mean, really dehydrated, you know, starting having a few dizzy spells. So I thought that as I came to the top of a ridge, I saw there was a village in the valley, about 5 or 6 houses. And I knew that most of those villages would have a general store. And in that general store, there'll be rope, there'll be lighters, there'll be kerosene, but there'd also be Pepsi Colas. They always had them there. And so at the top of that ridge, I'm being as accurate as possible. I said, look, I always wanted to find out if there are heavenly beings. So I made a resolution, a determination, they call it aditana. If there are heavenly beings, I was a good monk. I'm keeping my precepts. I'm trying the best to develop my mind. May you please help me by giving me a Pepsi Cola. I actually asked for it from the heavenly beings. And I said, this is also a test to see whether you really exist or not. That was from that story of that famous monk. So I walked down from that ridge, down into the village, and I kept my gaze 2 meters in front of me all the time. I never looked to the left or the right or said anything. And as I walked in that village, I could see in the corner of my eye there was a general store. I walked past it. No one said anything. And at that moment I thought there were no such things as heavenly beings. And then I heard someone behind me, Nimon Kwap! And then there was a man with an open bottle of Pepsi Cola. I never asked for anything. But then I thought that must be coincidence. And then another man came out with another bottle of Pepsi Cola opened to offer me. Then a woman came out with a third bottle of Pepsi Cola. Then another one with a fourth. Another one with a fifth. Another one with a sixth. Another one with a seventh. And the person came out with an eighth bottle of Pepsi Cola. And then lastly, a ninth bottle. I had 9 open bottles of Pepsi Cola with straws in them, ready for me to drink. And anyone who knows Thailand, is she here today? Someone had the t-shirt with the Thai number 9 on it. You've got it there. It's underneath there, is it? Yeah. What does that number 9 mean? Gao. It's a whole number. It means progress. Gao Na. And that means that was the luckiest number, the holiest number in Thailand. And I had 9 bottles of Pepsi Cola opened, ready for me to drink. And I said at that time, and it never happened to me ever again like that. I never asked for anything, never looked at anybody. And they gave me 9 bottles of Pepsi Cola. What I did was just drink the top of each bottle, because I couldn't drink that much, and gave the rest to the kids who were around. That's all I could drink. But as that convinced me, I can't convince you, because that didn't happen to you. But to me, that gave me full confidence that heavenly beings do exist. And they will help if you really need it. Anyway, you've got to be a good person, first of all. Okay, I did some of the questions. Quite a few more. Look at the how many I've got. But it's now 6 o'clock. We're supposed to finish now, aren't we? Okay. So I'll keep these here for tomorrow. They're probably really good questions. And we'll see what we can do tomorrow. Okay?